podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
And it's Casemiro! A thumping finish. And it is Rashford. And it is absolutely magnificent. What a strike from Marcus Rashford. Rashford. Absolutely brilliant. A rejuvenated Marcus Rashford is running riot for England.
Ah, the World Cup. A very warm welcome to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast as we reflect on the majority of the group stages of the 2022 World Cup. Some impressive performances from Manchester United players and potential Manchester United targets. So there's some enjoyed casual conversations we had between me, Harry Robinson, and my co-host Jack Tate, as always. But there's also some United chat to be had. And Jack, we'll start with England, I think, and with Marcus Rashford. Happy or proud? What was the main feeling watching his start to this World Cup?
I think it went from sort of proud to happy and then back to proud again. It was definitely proud in the Iran game when the result wasn't in question. And then his first goal against Wales, it was obviously happy that, you know, we got the breakthrough. And then it became pride again when the result wasn't in question and he scored the third goal.
Yeah,
it's just fun to watch Rashford playing good football, very clearly really high on confidence and just being the player that we've sort of known was in there and wanted to be shown more consistently and on sort of the biggest stages for a number of years now. It feels like everything is kind of coming together. It was particularly happy for me to see that his two goals, one of them, albeit from a set piece, but the other one came from playing on the right, which didn't seem to hamper him too much against Wales.
Scored with his left foot.
And his general play has, I think, been generally very good as well in games against teams that are generally sitting back against England as well, which also isn't a situation where Rashford often excels. So it's just great to see Rashford. He's always been a fan favourite of everyone because obviously he came to the academy and he had this great story coming on, bursting onto the scene. But he's only endeared himself more to the fans. And he, more than anyone, I think, is someone that we love to see doing well.
Yeah. I can't think of any of the United player that I have that feeling towards because of the way that he came through, of the struggles he's had to deal with being in and out of the team, sometimes under different managers, of bad form, of injuries, and all the off the pitch stuff, for which I don't think we can be any more proud than we are of him. And just to see him, like, it's just to see him happy and smiling is such a nice feeling. The scoring is one thing, but just to see, like, I saw a little clip on England's social media where I don't know whoever was behind the camera said, Rashi, two goals, you know, and he just broke out into like this like uncontrollable big grin. And I just love seeing that kind of happiness and pride come through in a footballer who we love like that. And yeah, it's been lovely. But I agree with you, it's not just the fact he scored, it's his all round play.
Yeah, he's been a massive bright spot. And I think he's hoping, both from a selfish point of view, because I obviously like Rashford a lot, but also from an England point of view, with the form that he's in, hope that he's given the start against Senegal on Sunday as well, because I think he's earned it.
Yeah, yeah. One of our patrons asks a pertinent question. Havard says, isn't it wonderful to see Rashford in such good form and spirit? Do we really have to get a rescue striker in the January window if he continues like this? Maybe we're good with him and Martial rotating up top and Alangro Garnacho as options. Now, I get the point, Rashford's playing well, but he's still playing well on the wing. And not only that, even if he was playing well up front, you only have to look at the injury records, especially of Martial, but also a bit of Rashford. And the fact that Rashford's form isn't, he's doing really well this season, it's great, but it's not always been consistent, to show how thin on the ground, I mean, non-existent we would be if Martial and Rashford weren't available up front. So I think we still need a rescue striker. That being said, you look at United's front line now and it looks, with Bruno in such good, he's playing really well at the World Cup as well and was playing well before the Premier League paused. You do look at United's front line and you're excited by it, knowing that we've got Garnacho to come back into the team after a good rest and a chance to improve himself. And Rashford's a big part of that.
To the actual question, do United need a rescue striker? I still think we do. Well, for a couple of reasons. Firstly, obviously, Martial, who is a big part of this equation, is notoriously injury prone. Yeah. Second, in all of those players, a lot of them, you're sort of counting them in as depth for multiple positions, which I think can make you feel slightly more confident in the depth that you've got. But actually, like that yeah. player could only fill one of them at a time. You know, so you could, in some ways, you could say Rashford could cover any of the three front positions, which then makes you think, oh, great, that's an extra option in left wing, striker and right wing. But obviously, Rashford can only play one of those positions at any time. So really, it can sort of lull you into a false sense of feeling like our depth is really good, but it's actually not. I think the other thing is you just don't, you kind of mentioned it. I also don't really want Rashford to be taken out of the position where he's playing so well. And so even if Martial did get injured, I think I would rather have a striker that is capable of playing up front and leave Rashford on the left than having to have him play up front where maybe you can play at sort of 70% of his top level and have someone like Sancho come in on the left wing. It is going to be interesting to see how United deal with the transfer window, because it is famously really difficult to find any sort of good deals in January. There have been a few rumours floating about recently of United looking at strikers in the transfer window, and this obviously is a very unique situation that United find themselves in. But it is going to be difficult to find any sort of great deal. And so then you're kind of looking at, is there an Ighalo or Cavani type player that United could maybe bring in on a short-term loan?
Yeah, well, we'll get onto Cody Gakpo in a bit. But just to wrap up on Rashford, I think the other really interesting thing that he keeps pointing out, and he did a press conference before the, I think it was before the Wales game. Could have been before the United States.
Yeah, it was before the Wales game.
Okay. In which he was again asked, like, why are you now playing better again? And he basically just again said, I'm injury free. And it's amazing to think that how much of a difference that makes. And I think it's partly also a better team at United now. But we also didn't see this kind of form for England a year or two ago. And because we know that footballers are normally playing with injuries. And then you see what can happen when they're playing completely injury free. And he's now been completely injury free for about a month or two. And it's crazy. The confidence and the directness and scoring a set piece as well, which he hasn't done, a free kick, which he hasn't done for a while. Although the keeper probably could have done better. But yeah, Maguire and Shaw. Maguire's doing well, isn't he?
Yeah, he's been brilliant. Been very good. I think United all round have had a... United players have had
it's
a
been
very
a great
good
group
World
stage
Cup.
Yeah, for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So many players performing really well. And yeah, Maguire, I mean, Shaw's been good as well, but it's, I guess, been a little bit more expected. Maguire was the one where there's a few more question marks about what his performance level could be in this World Cup. And he's been excellent. I mean, deservedly man of the match against the USA. He was good when needed against Iran. And I think in both the Iran and Wales games, you've seen some of his ability passing forward as well. A couple of comical sort of marauding runs forward, which I enjoyed a lot. And,
one beautiful spin and run in the box as well.
And then the throw-in, the shot that goes out for a throw-in to finish off one of those runs just kind of topped it off perfectly. I mean, I've got to say, I'm really happy for Maguire. We've obviously criticised his performances, which I think everyone has, and rightly so for United, but I have always felt that he is slightly unfairly criticised, and a lot of the sort of criticism and dislike of Maguire is a lot more about his style than actually the substance of his play. And so I'm glad that he's kind of getting the headlines again. He's always played well for England. Yeah. It's a team and a system that suits him well. And, I'm not that surprised that he's playing well in this World Cup, because he's maybe had a couple of bad games for England. There was one where he obviously got sent off at the start of, 2020 season? I can't remember which one.
It was just after he'd come back from the Greece controversy. Then played in the 6-1, lost to Spurs, and then went and got sent off for England and gave away. It was a shocking month for him.
And there was one bad game for England. Was it the Hungary game where he was bad earlier this season?
Yeah, I think so.
Or was it Germany? Something like that.
Yeah.
But in general, he's always done really well for England.
And he's doing really well. And I agree with you. I'm really happy for him as a person and a player. But does it for you, because it doesn't for me, does it change anything you think about his United future? And it doesn't for me, because I'm very happy he's doing well and it will be useful for the second half of the season. Or if he continues to have a very good World Cup and suddenly there are some interested clubs, United would be wise to cash in when he's on good form and in the headlines, because I don't think what he's doing here, we know this is what he's good at, but it's not the centre-back that Ten Hag wants long-term. but I am very happy for him.
Yeah, I don't think it changes anything, really. I think it's just an example that it's sort of a good, I guess, indication that kind of horses for courses exists in football, you know, and that whether it's because of confidence or about just the way that England play suiting him more, Maguire is much better at playing in this England team than he is in this United team. And that's okay. And that the consequence of that means that you sort of have to treat Maguire's sort of play, I guess, slightly separately for England and for United. And that's okay. I don't think that changes very much about how United sort of centre-back pecking order is going to shape up after this World Cup. I think he'll still stay sort of borderline third or fourth choice, definitely behind Martinez and Varane, probably behind Lindelof as well. And I don't think there's a problem with that.
Yeah. Let's rattle through a few other great moments for United players. I'd actually forgotten this when I was quickly noting them down, but one of them, just Raphael Varane being able to play for France. I'm very, because when he came off the scene, there were some people saying he was overreacting, but he clearly thought he was going to miss the World Cup at that point. This is potentially his final World Cup. How old is he now? Is he 29 or 30? I can't quite remember, but there's a chance, given the quality that France have in their national team and in their youth teams, this is probably his final World Cup. And he clearly thought he was going to miss it when he got injured at Chelsea. For him to start the second game is, for him, very, very pleased for him as well.
Yeah, it was great to see him back in the last game for France. Massive player for United. I've got to say, I'm a little bit scared every time I see him on the France team sheet that he's going to re-aggravate that injury. But it's been okay so far. He didn't have the best game today against Tunisia, in fairness, in a very depleted and much changed France backline. But it'll be interesting to see if he starts in the knockout stages, because Konaté came in and played very well. Yeah. So, but regardless, from a United point of view, it's really good to see him just back on the pitch, seemingly fit again.
Yeah. And look, we're only a couple of, well, some teams 3 games in, some 2 in. We're recording this just after the, I think I meant to say it's at the start, actually. We're recording this just after the Argentina game against Poland and Mexico against Saudi Arabia, which, I mean, the World Cup just gives you these mad situations where I was sitting there praying for Poland to get 2 yellow cards so that the World Cup group C, or whichever group it was, I think it's C, could be decided on a coin toss. That would have just been one of the great World Cup moments.
Yeah, I was just rooting for the most chaos and controversy you could possibly get. That's all I wanted from that.
On a real note, I was disappointed Mexico didn't either find the third goal or Argentina didn't score a third goal, because Poland have offered nothing in these group stages, and they've sat back, and they sat back at 2-0 down against Argentina, and they were basically wasting time.
Yeah.
And that's just so against, I mean, I'm not going to say, no, I'm not going to say it's against the spirit of the game. I'm not using that cliche, but because ultimately the spirit of the game is winning, but they didn't win. They went through with 4 points and played poorly in for the vast majority of the group stages, whereas Mexico, A, have a nicer kit, and B, to take things down to the most elementary level, and scored an amazing free kick and went for it in the most brilliant way against Saudi Arabia. And yeah, I would have liked to see them be rewarded for that.
Yeah, I've got to say the sort of second tier of European international teams are extremely uninspiring. I've often felt this about Switzerland too, who seem to pop up in every single tournament, get through to like the last 16 or quarterfinal.
Good players as well.
It's always the same, very sort of just not particularly interested, not very memorable, but somewhat effective football. And Poland have kind of lived up to that this year. I'd much rather have seen someone like Mexico, or just in general, any sort of other teams from any other continent other than Europe kind of getting through this, because A, they're teams that we don't watch quite as often, and B, I think they tend to go for it a bit more than some of these sort of second tier UEFA teams.
Yeah, Bruno for Portugal, Casemiro for Brazil, goals, assists, everything we'd want. And all of this is just to say, from a United perspective, A, we like seeing our players do well, but also, and yet we're only a few games in, and things could turn out very badly for a player or two going into the latter stages. Who knows what's going on, goal, be sent off, whatever, miss a penalty. But as things stand, all of our players are doing well. All of them. Eriksen's Denmark haven't had a great time, surprisingly bad. But the majority of them are having a great time and could all come back just buoyed, in a great mood, in a United dressing room that seems to be picking up in terms of its togetherness and happiness, especially with Ronaldo gone now, not causing as many problems. But yeah, Bruno and Casemiro, good starts for them as well.
Casemiro, you talked about with Rashford, sort of the feeling that that we get when we watch Rashford and he scores. The feeling that I get when I watch Casemiro is it feels surreal, honestly, that a player that is just quite clearly so good plays for United. Honestly, that's how I feel.
How the mighty have fallen, eh?
Yeah. It just, in both of Brazil's games so far, he's been just head and shoulders above anyone else on the pitch, really. I think he won, definitely won man of the match in the first game. Did he win it in the second game for Brazil too?
I can't remember.
He was definitely, in my book anyway, one of the best players on the park. And he's just a joy to watch, Casemiro, because he does his job so effectively without sort of trying to do anything that he's not particularly great at. And I think he, more than anyone, is just someone that I massively appreciate what he brings to any side that he plays in. And then, Bruno has been doing Bruno things. To be honest, it's kind of what you come to expect at this point. It was hilarious seeing all the furore around whether Ronaldo got a touch on his cross or not. It's just so funny.
Yeah.
Quite thankful that isn't part of the United experience anymore. But I'm glad for Bruno that he's playing well and seems to have... He hasn't always found sort of the right fit in that Portugal team, and he seems to have done so now, which is really good to see.
Yeah, and I think that's part of it. I wasn't expecting a huge amount from Portugal going into the tournament because of the fact they've often failed to find that fluency between what is undoubtedly a set of really, really talented players. But just the fact that Bruno seems to be fitting in better suddenly makes me think, because they're going to be on England's side of the draw pretty sure. You suddenly think, oh wow, they'd be a real test if England are going to beat Senegal, which I think will be really difficult. There's been some great moments at the World Cup so far, hasn't there? The Saudi game against Argentina was amazing. The Japan defeat of Germany was amazing. Today the Australia celebrations at like 3-4 a.m. back home in Australia were that was great to see. And it feels like there's quite a few of these, and maybe you'll know more about this, given that you're US, these big moments where developing football nations, and I think it's still fair to call Australia and the US developing, are having their moments where it maybe it will erupt.
Yeah, it's always a nice part of the World Cup, because you do get countries where either they just don't have sort of the biggest pedigree in football, both domestically and internationally. And also you get countries that where football just isn't the main sport, sort of getting its moment in the spotlight. And it's always fun to kind of see that happen and see the reaction to it. I mean, yeah, you're right. The videos that have come, that we've been seeing in the last few hours in Australia, the celebrations there were great. I mean, some of the footage that we've seen from like Melbourne, for example, it looked like a Champions League game in like Turkey or something. Honestly, with all the flares going off, everyone's just jumping in the street.
3-4 in the morning. I loved it.
Yeah. I mean, just to be honest, just the fact that many people were out there watching at 3 a.m, regardless of the celebration, is impressive enough. So yeah, it's been great. I mean, it really has in the US been a big deal unfortunately, given how bad the game was, I think that the game on Friday between the US and England, given it was Black Friday as well, was like the most watched football game in history.
Wow.
In the US, women's football has always been arguably more popular in the US than the men's football, because the US women's team has been so good for so long. But I think there's a real... This current US American team is extremely young, and I think that has got a lot of people excited about sort of what might be to come. But yeah, it's just always fun, isn't it? Seeing different sort of football and cultures come together, like seeing the Argentina fans in the stadium today were absolutely brilliant. Even like all the Wales fans, honestly, were great throughout.
The Welsh traveling support's incredible. But yeah, the Argentina, they just made that like a home game. It was amazing. The entire way around the stadium just filled with blue and white and a very occasional River Plate shirt. They travel in the most ridiculous numbers, and the noise they create is not just such big noise, but I much prefer it. I think English culture and South American culture is much more closely linked than English football culture and like German, French, Spanish, Italian, because to me, the European fan culture, not all of it, but a lot of it, is about noise, whereas the Argentinians are basically a louder English. They still have the funny witty and creativity and originality, but they just do it on a even more ridiculous scale and more organized. Well, I love it. And I went, I was there for a couple of months a few years ago, and I never even got to go to Boca Juniors. I went to River Plate, but I went to Argentinos Juniors, Diego Maradona's first club, and like quite a small ground. The stadium's named after him. The players come out of, you've seen it on Twitter, no doubt, the inflatable Maradona head where the players walk.
That's the
tunnel at Argentinos. And that's a small ground, but the just the noise and everything about it. It's like on the very edge of sensory overload, but in the complete perfect way of like fireworks and drums and these amazing smells and everything. It was great. And yeah, you're right. We're going to have to mention for a second now, we're talking so positively about the World Cup, but because of its location, this is with Argentina, because they travel anywhere and it's not easy for them to get to, although there are, because of the links between Argentina and the Middle East, there are loads of flights over. But seeing the number of fans from African countries, amazing, and from countries vaguely around the Middle East, because it's easier to get to, because it's much easier to get visas to, for example, compared to like Russia or compared to 2026 when it's in the US, has been one of the benefits of this, and has been an advert for having a World Cup in that part of the world. I think we've spoken about the many caveats before, but and I'm going to put them there again, but I do think that's a positive worth pointing out, that the sheer numbers of Ghana fans and Cameroon fans has been amazing, and seeing the videos of them walking through the street, this is brilliant. This is what we all want to see. Unfortunately, there are the many caveats.
The basic idea of having World Cups in, I guess I'm going to call it sort of non-traditional, sort of really powerful football countries, is a great idea. You saw that with South Africa too in 2010, and you know, going back to Korea and Japan in 2002. But I know in 2010 the Vuvuzelas weren't that popular with people watching, but it's an example of how, despite the fact that not everyone in the stadium is from whatever country it's hosting it, you do get this huge influx of just new footballing culture, new footballing sort of viewing experience that comes to the fore, whether it's that country's, whether it's being hosted kind of football culture, or whether it's just because you get fans from different countries that normally are able to go to World Cups attending. You know, in the next World Cup in the US, Canada, Mexico, I'm sure it'll have a big South American flair to it as well, because the football culture, you know, just from my experience going to like MLS games, the footballing culture, to the extent that sort of especially the fan culture exists, it is heavily influenced by Central American, South American kind of football culture's big focus on music and drums. And like you mentioned, it's very similar to what you see in like Argentina, Colombia, Brazil.
Yeah.
So that will have a lot of that there. When you went to Korea and Japan in 2002, it was again, just different experiences.
I was just going to say, you see the legacy of the 2002 World Cup with the, for example, the South Korea against Ghana. The South Korean support in that game, brilliant. There were so many shots at the South Korea end of just like the most brilliant displays of emotion. It was so harsh on them in the end. And that was an amazing morning where you had Cameroon 3, Serbia 3, and then Korea 2, Ghana 3. That was like one of those dream World Cup mornings. It would have been too early for you to probably watch live, I'd assume, because for me and in the UK, that was a 10 a.m. game and then a 1 p.m. game. But that was like one of those unique, one of those mornings you only get in the World Cup where you're watching football at 10 a.m. and then it's just this crazy, chaotic game.
Yeah, and teams that you would never normally watch.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you got told that Cameroon against Serbia was like a friendly and an international break, you'd never bother sitting down and watch it. You know, but in a World Cup, it's suddenly like the biggest game that you could ever think of.
That being said, the caveats. Better articulated people have articulated this better than we will. But as a overall point, and this is a big question and one that academics will ponder for many, many years to come, so I'm not expecting a perfect answer, but do you think so far for Qatar it's been a success or a failure?
I mean, I guess it depends by what metric you're kind of measuring it by. Because if you're measuring it by, I guess, sort of Western media coverage, it's probably been a failure. Because if anything, the coverage has got, and to be honest, I have a little bit of a problem with the way the coverage has been going, but it's. I think the hope would have been that the sort of controversial side of things would go to the side once the football actually started. And if anything, the opposite has happened and it's been played up to an even greater extent than it was before. So I guess as you measure it by that metric, it's probably not been a great success, but I'm sure financially which is probably an even bigger one, it probably has been a great success because there's still been a lot of visitors to Qatar. I think actually most of the people that have been attending games in Qatar have had generally quite a good experience there. There have been a few notable incidents, especially around sort of like LGBT supporting, like not even protests, just sort of colours that have been brought into stadiums.
Yeah, but I think you're right. I think what's more interesting is that this has probably been, I don't think there's been any success here for FIFA. I think there's only been failure.
Yeah, not at all.
So Qatar are kind of on this balance where, yes, they're getting loads of negative coverage in the Western media, but how much does that really affect them? They're still making deals with the British government, with the American government, with the Argentinian government. Who cares? We care, but to them, what does it matter if the Guardian or the Times are saying you're doing things wrong? And not only that, but their paid ambassadors, such as John Barnes and many others, and David Beckham, are winning lots of Western people over to a quite frankly ridiculous argument about respecting their values. So in that sense, maybe it's leaning towards success for them, unfortunately. But I think for FIFA, one final point of Qatar, the fact their football team did so badly is a massive blow for them because they spent a lot of money. They weren't just trying to host the World Cup. They were trying to have a good football team and they failed that in a big, big way. They really, really played poorly.
And haven't actually had some success in the past couple of years. They won the Asia Cup in 2019. They actually had on paper a decent enough team. Yeah, that was probably the biggest sort of downside they've had so far. I have kind of a slightly long-winded, but hopefully nuanced enough take on sort of all the controversy surrounding Qatar, which is that you're right that in the people I think that are really losing out from this World Cup is FIFA. And actually, I think that needs to be made a much bigger deal than it currently is. Because
I agree,
all the focus on sort of Qatar's policies, especially the sort of anti-LGBTQ laws, focus on human rights, I completely understand it. But I think it is difficult when that's the only thing that you focus on because that is completely separate to the World Cup itself. And so it opens up this whole sort of world, I think, where, where do we draw the line of which policies are acceptable or unacceptable for a country to have so that we don't bring it up during a World Cup? You know, I'm living in a country now in America where, you know, there's mass shootings every day. Abortion is illegal in half the states. Is that acceptable for a country in the next World Cup? You know, in the first week of the World Cup, there's multiple mass shootings across the US. Is that just an okay thing? You know, people like Gary Lineker and Alex Scott, who have been vocal about their opposition to it being held in Qatar, and then pictures with Putin from 2018. You know, so we're just fine with that, but not in Qatar. To me, the focus should be more on things that the World Cup directly created, which to me is A, sort of the corruption within FIFA, which is still ongoing. And I think, you know, Gianni Infantino has only made that worse with some of the ridiculous speeches that he's been giving recently. But also the biggest one, I think, is just the treatment of workers that were brought in primarily from South Asia. You know, this World Cup has literally been built on the backs of people that were housed in terrible conditions, paid horrible wages and were promised a lot bigger wages than they were actually given. Hundreds of people died in the creation of these stadiums. Like, that is something you can say directly because of the World Cup being in Qatar, hundreds of people have died. You know, that is, I think, what the focus should be on. And that ties in a lot more back to FIFA than it does to policies that are outside of the World Cup, which I think it's just difficult to know where you draw the line in that case, because you could then say, well,
yeah, agreed.
You know, 90% of every country in the world shouldn't be allowed to host the World Cup.
Agree. And FIFA have a responsibility to set out a set of regulations for a World Cup host that weren't adhered to in Qatar, weren't adhered to in Russia, definitely weren't adhered to in Brazil either, where there were deaths in stadium construction.
Yeah.
The last three World Cups have really having, the history of the World Cup's really strange because right from its very start, it has been intrinsically linked to politics and there's no getting away from that. And pretty much every World Cup is political, but one in every three or four at the very minimum has been not just like linked a little bit to politics, but fundamentally overtaken completely by something political, whether it's Mussolini in 1934, the Junta in 1978, or Putin in 2018. And many other ones. Those are probably the three most famous so far until Qatar. But I think the final that there had been for quite a while up to Brazil, Russia and Qatar, it had kind of become, I think the World Cup had become more pure and it had become more commercialized, definitely. But I think it had also strangely become a more pure place. Unfortunately, the last three have kind of steadily gone from kind of bad Brazil, very bad Russia, to even worse Qatar. We haven't got much longer to talk, but yeah, I think the pressure, the pressure should absolutely be on FIFA.
Have you watched by any chance the new Netflix documentary about FIFA?
No, the one great thing I read rather than watched about FIFA was a book by a New York Times journalist, Ken Bettinger, I think is his name, but I read this about 4 years ago, so I might have got that wrong. But the book was called Red Card, and it was, I remember reading it, my sister got it for me for my birthday, amazing book, detailing the entire FIFA case and the FBI's investigation into it. And I remember finishing it and sending a message to her saying, that was great, thank you. Someone needs to turn that into a film. Because the story, but also the way it was written, was just brilliant. And so I'm not surprised it became a thing, but lots of my mates, it's meant to be very good, isn't
it? Yeah, it was great. And I think the story of FIFA corruption, I think for a lot of people that maybe weren't like completely clued in with FIFA, as most football fans aren't on like a daily basis, the story of corruption in FIFA sort of began and ended with awarding the World Cup to Russia and Qatar.
Yeah.
But actually learning how far back it has gone and the fact that
the entire time, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And like even the awarding of the World Cup in South Africa was riddled with corruption as well. And that just the whole setup of FIFA being this hugely commercial enterprise that rakes in so much money, but at the same time doesn't really have a hard product that it sells. Everything it sells is a bit wishy-washy, and it's very easy therefore to create these sort of dodgy deals where you're selling something that's very vague, because everything that FIFA sells is quite vague. And so it's just fascinating how sort of the whole setup of FIFA as an organization is very open to be taken advantage of.
And FIFA is where change really can be made as well, because we can all talk about Qatar and Qatar's laws. As you've said, you're on dodgy ground there anyway, when it comes to specifically the World Cup. But our governments are still dealing with them, and our businesses, like the businesses in the United Kingdom and the United States, are still dealing with them. So how much change is that really going to make? But FIFA is where us as football fans can genuinely urge and encourage change. And I'm a bit disappointed so far in the English Football Association, at least, how they've responded to what FIFA have done, not just in the original awarding of it, but in the denying of them of wearing the rainbow armband, etc., taking love, the word love, off of the Denmark shirts is just absolute insanity. And I'm a bit disappointed in yet to see a really strong response from any association, actually. But I am also wary in saying that, because things could be going on behind the scenes which could suddenly erupt in a month or two. And that's going to be very interesting and potentially very exciting to watch. We need to wrap up, and we've got another question. Well, it's more of a remark. It's on transfers and on Cody Gakpo, who scored 3 goals in 3 games for the Netherlands. We're going to go back to on the pitch on the football stuff. He looks good, doesn't he? I'm not 100% convinced yet, but he has clearly got something about him. And one of our patrons, Steve K, makes this remark, which I'm not sure I agree with, but I'll give it anyway. He says, Louis van Gaal hates United so much, he's sending Gakpo out to score in every game just to push his price up and cost us a few more million. That level of bitterness and spite is almost admirable. I don't think that's happening. And actually, I'm loving seeing Louis van Gaal again. I'd love to see him, if England can't go all the way, and we'll see, because it's been good but not amazing so far. But I would love to see Louis van Gaal, regardless of my own support of England, I'd love to see him bow out of football with an incredible World Cup win with the Netherlands. But Gakpo, what do you think from the first 3 games?
I mean, he looks good. You got to say that first of all. I think my slight concern before this World Cup, albeit having watched very little of him, was a couple of things. One was just the level of quality and whether that is enough to kind of make him worth as much as United are probably going to have to pay for him. And then B, whether he can play properly up front, or if he more plays off the left, where we obviously have a lot of options already. And I think he's starting to address both of those fears through how well he's played at this World Cup so far.
Yeah. The only other thing to mention before we wrap up, and we've probably gone on a little bit longer than we anticipated, but the officiating and specifically added time, which I have really enjoyed. I think we were trying to be a bit careful about not using it as an excuse too much last season or this season, but so many times I spoke about it. I can't remember which game, maybe Aston Villa, possibly, where I've been at Old Trafford and genuinely just been driven to boredom by how bad the time wasting has been by an opposition side there. And the worst I think I can remember is Aston Villa last season at Old Trafford. Emi Martinez, a particular foul, a sinner in that regard. Everton also did it terribly. West Ham have also done it terribly. And I just think it ruins football as a spectacle. And I think the steps... we've criticised FIFA a lot. The steps FIFA have taken here, Pierluigi Collina, as the head of referees, recommending them to properly add time on for any time the ball is out of play, is brilliant and has made for much more entertaining games. And in the end, has actually made for some incredible periods of added time as well.
Yeah, it's been a shock, definitely. The first couple of games in particular, like, you often kind of hear these like refereeing directives and then you're still kind of stunned by them when they happen. So seeing like the first England game was especially an aberration, because there was actually in both halves some genuine reasons why that much added time would be needed. So I think England's first game went on for something like 115, 120 minutes in total, which was just an interesting watch. I'm sort of fully on board with the idea of actually making added time take into account all of the stoppages that have happened. Because as you were just mentioning, it definitely doesn't currently. My only slight concern is a couple of things. One is that I feel like there are probably better solutions than just adding on 10, 15 minutes and at a time occasionally. I just, somehow the optics of a 90-minute game actually going on for like 105, 110 minutes doesn't sit right with me. Even though it is, I think, an improvement on the ball only being in play for like 20 minutes of a half and then adding on 3 minutes at the end and calling it a day. The other thing that I think is just slightly weird, and I think this is something players will get better at dealing with if this is something that happens in sort of domestic leagues as well, is that teams are still kind of approaching the end of the game the same. So like, you know, a team, if you're protecting a one goal lead, you play differently in the 75th minute than you do in the 85th minute, let's say, yeah. Right? Because you get more defensive generally, you're more willing to just kind of park the bus and hang on. But now at 85 minutes, rather than there being 5 minutes and then maybe 3 or 4 minutes of added time, you might have like 15 minutes of the game left because you've got 5 minutes and then maybe 10 minutes of added time. So players, I think, just need to understand that 85 minutes doesn't necessarily mean what 85 minutes used to
mean. Is that not better?
No, I think that's a good thing. It's strange at the moment. So in the South Korea Ghana game, for example, like at the end of that game, it was literally like 20 minutes straight of South Korea just like barrage against at Ghana's defense. So it's just on the players to learn and deal with it, because it's still sort of solving the problem of a team being able to time waste so much and get away with basically the ball only being in play for like 15 or 20 minutes.
Half. I think it's interesting to say that, because I thought about the first half that it's made teams less likely to just let the first half fizzle out at 40 minutes.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And even going on into added time. I haven't noticed the same kind of level of, it's almost half time, let's just sack it off. And I've enjoyed that. I think it's brilliant. And I think you're already seeing that it's going from 14 minutes added on to 6 for most games because players aren't time wasting. It's very simple. You punish people for doing something wrong in football, they learn within a week or two. It's not difficult. And I've consistently said this about time wasting in the Premier League. It would be fixed within 2 weeks, 3 or 4 match days. And I think the same applies to, for example, and this is something FIFA have tried to do at World Cups, pulling at corners for professional, what we call professional fouls, when people just take someone out on the counter-attack. Start giving red cards for them, they'll be gone in 2 weeks. It's so easy, but this is the first time I've seen it really done really well. And I wish it would come into the Premier League, but I'm convinced they won't do it. And I don't know why. They never seem interested in stopping time wasting in the Premier League.
Yeah, it is an interesting one, because you'd think that the product, like what incentivizes people like the Premier League is money, ultimately. And you'd think that there is more money to be earned by the games being on for longer, and you improve that product and keep people more engaged. But I mean, maybe it doesn't. Maybe the difference between the game, the ball being in play for, you know, 25 minutes versus 30 minutes of a half doesn't make that much difference for sort of viewer engagement. Maybe they make money off adverts more than they do off the game. I don't know, but it does feel like something that would, like you said, it's very easy to fix. Football players, more so than most, respond very clearly to the incentives that are put in front of them. And so if you make something punished to a much higher degree, they will change their behaviour on it very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. We should wrap up. Anything else?
Just quickly, thoughts on, it didn't end up happening, but thoughts on Poland and Mexico's tiebreaker potentially being decided on fair play?
What do I think? There should be something else.
I don't know. It feels strange that, so where the stakes are so high, it could end up being decided by that. But I don't really know what else it could be.
Especially in, I think that makes a lot more sense, like in a league where there's been 32 games or something. So it's kind of a fair way. Because in a league, if there's been 32 games and you can't be separated by goals scored, goals against, etc., that you have to find somewhere. But when it's only been three games, you think, is that enough time for things to balance out, where one team might have just been in kind of a really aggressive, intense game and another one might not have been?
I sort of wonder if there isn't a way that you could do it that like somehow controls better for like referee temperament as well. Like there are certain referees that are just famous for giving out more cards. And obviously at a World Cup, like you said, when you're only playing three games, you get one game where a ref's giving out 10 cards to each team. That's going to effectively, it's not going to send you out, because obviously you have to be equal on a lot of other things first, but could end up, you know, having a big deal breaker. I wonder if you could say like the same two referees referee every game in a group and each team is refereed by each one once, or
I think you're better off just changing the rule.
Yeah. I'm sure this won't actually happen, but I did see an article saying that for the next World Cup, where there's only going to be two group games, it's going to be 48 teams, but groups of three, that they could bring in penalty shootouts.
I think that will happen.
To decide to get like an extra bonus point if a game is drawn.
I think that's a serious suggestion and probably will happen. I think it's silly, but I think it will happen.
I mean, that is literally a pre-season tournament.
It happens in the Papa John's Trophy and in one of the US women's soccer competitions. I can't remember which. And in the Continental Cup in women's football in the UK as well. Me and my mates were coming up with a variety of suggestions instead of if the fair play was going to be drawn. So if Poland got their two extra cards, we were deciding. I suggested a five-a-side tournament on the beach the next morning between Poland, that just get all the players involved. They can choose their five-a-side, one or two subs allowed, and like first to 10 or something, or get the managers to do like a mastermind style quiz.
I was going to say, I like the idea of a little pub quiz or something.
Yeah, just between the managers as well. And they each get to choose. Maybe there's one general knowledge round, one World Cup round, and then they each get, so the general knowledge can be World Cup, and then they each get to choose a round on their speciality, but the other one gets to play it as well, just in case they're good at it, and see what happens. And I'd like it to be in like a dark room. Each manager has like a glass of whiskey and a cigar, and then it's broadcast live in a stadium with 40,000 Mexico fans in one end, 40,000 Poland fans in the other, and just carnage ensues. So they were some of my ideas. I had quite a few more, but I won't go through them all.
I like the. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, I was purely pulling for just chaos and controversy at the end of there. So anything that creates more of that, I think. There is so much that has to go into this scenario even taking place that we should just lean into the chaos that it's going to create.
Yeah. There should be a rule properly ridiculous for that scenario. But I guess it's a lot more likely in a three.
Well, yeah. Which I'm guessing is why they want to put the penalties on top of every group game.
Yeah. It's just, adding more penalty shootouts is not what
the craziest part about that idea that I saw was that they are considering doing the penalties before the game. So I mean, again, this was just from one article, but it was from a credible source that
But then someone could play for a draw.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Have
you seen how many 0-0s there's been in this World Cup? Imagine that how many there'll be at the next one. If every time you play a game, one team knows that they can't draw the game. And one team knows that if they just sit back and get a draw, they'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's FIFA, eh? Let's wrap up. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. For more from Jack during the next week or so of the World Cup, you can find him on Twitter at
UTDTait, T-A-I-T.
You can find me at HarryRobinson64 and the podcast itself at UTD Weekly Pod. That's P-O-D at the end there. United Women host Aston Villa this weekend on Saturday, 12:30 at Old Trafford. 30,000 plus crowd expected. I'm sure that will increase significantly before the day itself, but there are tickets available for, I think, £6 for adults, £3 for kids. If anyone wants to go to that, it should be pretty fun. We previewed that in our last episode, episode 26, with an interview with United centre-back Millie Turner. So if you haven't listened to that yet and you're interested, check that out. And the academy teams have been in action. We'll tell you a bit more about that next time. Most important news on that front is that the under-18s are playing away to Crystal Palace in the third round of the FA Youth Cup, and the under-21s are playing away at Bolton Wanderers first team in the Papa John's Trophy. Both of those games will be in about 2 weeks' time, 2 to 3 weeks' time. So those are two to keep an eye on. They'll be really interesting and could be great, could be a good learning opportunity. We'll see how that goes. But thanks for listening. Have a great week. Goodbye.
Network.